Good morning, everyone. Hope you had something to eat downstairs. And for some of us, what a wonderful way to start this day with ceremony by our beautiful Silver Lake with the sunrise. Special thanks to our pastor, Jim Bear Jacobs, and also to our dear friend, Bob Klanderud, for leading us in that sacred ceremony. This morning, our presenters, there are four of them, and I have the privilege of introducing them. For those of you who weren't here yesterday or the day before, my name is Jin S. Kim, and I'm pastor here at Church of All Nations, a congregation that I have the privilege of serving, my family. Let me say a few words about Chad and Elaine, who will be speaking this morning. They are wife and husband. Elaine has been working in the field of restorative justice for a long time, 1989, before I was born. I know I keep saying that. Yeah, you know, I'm one of those young millennial types. It's kind of an in thing to be these days, you know. And she's been, she's from Canada and has really been working on restorative justice through that lens of the Indigenous people in Canada and settler history there. And so she, I think, brings some unique perspectives to that work for those of us who've been in the United States for a long time. And her husband, Chad, is a longtime activist, theologian. Many of us, including myself, ran into him through his seminal work, Binding the Strong Man, and opened up the Bible in such amazing and unique ways. And there are so many people around the world who call him a mentor, including our church. So we're really, really grateful for them. And interestingly, I only met Chad face-to-face not much more than a year ago at the Wild Goose Festival in North Carolina. And I saw Chad with Tevin and Jay together. So I met all of them at the same time, where I observed all of them. And I mean, Chad has such an amazing bio. Many of you know him and know of him and are here because of his work. But the first time I ever saw him face to face, he was in some octopus costume. Squid, thank you. The squish-up. And I thought, he is our leader? Yeah. The Lord works in mysterious ways, amen? And we've connected through radical theological education, and now not just through written works and broadcasts and internet and things like that, but face-to-face, in person. He and Elaine have become such important figures for us, and just such dear, dear friends and comrades in this important work that we're in. So as I was saying, he was part of the Carnival de Resistance at the festival, and I saw Jay and Tevin and others, part of that troop, doing some amazing storytelling through word and song and dance and play and real water in their water show. So delightful, so powerful. And we're just so amazed that they're all here physically in Minnesota. How did that happen? So we're so, so thankful to God for their amazing talent and their contributions to the Christian community. So Jay is a percussionist, a vocalist, a drum maker, an educator, and he has been a recording professional, teaching and touring for many years. And he collaborates with his wife and boss, Tevin East, who is the director of Carnival de Resistance and has incorporated Sabbath economics into their work in really powerful ways. So they do travel, and they are here, and we're grateful for those who are hosting them and making all this possible at, how do you say, at radical cost. There's like regular conference, you know, cost, and then there's radical conference cost. So we're really grateful for the hearts of longtime veterans and leaders in this movement who contribute so graciously to make our learning and growth and transformation possible. Thank you so much for that, what was it, freestyling introduction of me last night. I'm sorry, I cannot reciprocate. Yeah, a closet millennial. So anyway, we have such a great morning ahead of us, and I'll have Tevin and Jay lead us off.
L'acqua è santo, l'acqua è vita, l'acqua è la medicina. We rise up from the ocean by the heat of the sun. We come together as clouds through the sky we float on. We bring life as we rain upon the plains and mountains. We delve deep into the earth until the wells overrun. We flow free over the soils as the streams we run. We come home back to the oceans we came from. We're reborn in new forms. Our journey's never done. We are the blood of the earth, the circulation, and we may change shape, but we are all one. Yes, we may change shape, but we are all one. We may change shape, but we are all one.
Water, water, ancient life giver, dimension of earth formed in the beginning. It is our beginning. In circulation from the start, a fixed supply. Eternally renewing. Water, it is by its own right. It is by its own reality. Up to my waist in the Nile water, I watch. I can hear the cries of my baby brother, Moses, our beloved, Moses floating in an ark pitched with bitumen. Moses re-emerges from the river currents with a new future. From the river is born a new future. future for my people. Pharaoh's daughter, that princess, that spark of defiance, her heart is hooked. Disobedience calls out like a woman's song, calls out against a cruel system. I come out of the water. I am Miriam, daughter of Israel. I dreamt the Nile River as a fallopian tube. I birthed new life pushed out of the Red Sea's womb. The groaning of the earth is inside the woman's song. We who've known the birth pangs and the labor and have for so long. We who renew life every time it's cut down with our blood, through our sweat, in our wailing sound. The divine feminine is begging for you to understand. When you ravish the earth, her womb dries up like desert sand. The integrity of the water is the health of the land. You erode her flesh into infertile hard pan. When will you stop? When will these actions be banned? My tears alone cannot water the land. My tears alone cannot water the land. My song. My song is the body song. The body song rings true. The body song sings us through. This body that has had slavery strapped to its back, grief tucked in its arms, bitterness choking the throat, and a thousand hopes piercing the chest. This body remembers so much. Our singing, our striving, our Red Sea crossing was not complete without the body song. One long, spiraling dance that stretched to God and to the future. And the women, they followed me, and we sang completeness. We sang deliverance. Oh, ecstasy! We are safe. Oh, ecstasy! We are free. Oh, exult! The warring man has been swallowed by the sea. The warring man has been thrown into the sea. Our singing, our striving, our Red Sea crossing was a mighty triumph of faith. But it was only just the beginning. We had so very much to learn. My people had so very much to learn. We have so very much to learn.
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you, Baptist. Elaine and I are so grateful for this morning's prayer and pipe for this congregation, and particularly to have our comments this morning surrounded by the prophetic and aesthetic witness of Tevin East and Jay Beck, excerpts from their magnificent water show of the Carnaval de Resistance project. Elaine and I lean on the imagination of artists because, as we've already named several times, the task before us, friends, frankly, is demanding, even if compelling, work that we settler folk are invited and challenged by the gospel to do in the places that we dwell. So this morning I'm going to speak a little bit about our responsibilities to building right relations with our places, and Elaine is going to do the same about building right relations with the people and peoples of our places. I'm, for the first time, using a smartass phone as an advancer, so we'll see how we do. For Elaine and I, and many of the CANS staff, the work of this conference really began on Tuesday of this week when we journeyed together with interns and underground seminary students up to Itasca State Park in the headwaters of the Mississippi River. There we had a two-day retreat in which we went multiple times to those headwaters to gain clarity and strength for our work this weekend, which, after all, is all about swimming upstream against the currents of imperial society and culture to find the origins of our captivity and our liberation. The retreat was a rich time of sharing from the heart waters of our lives about this journey in such a powerful and symbolic place. Being at Itasca was so moving and reminded me of the headwaters of our faith tradition. I'm talking about the old wise stories, which, as Native writer Leslie Silko put it, alone can save us from illness and death, but only if we do not forget them or become confused about them. And the headwaters of our scriptures are the ancient origin stories. And in Genesis 2, we find a story about, well, about headwaters. We are told in this primeval tale that in the beginning a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and then it divided into four branches to water the world. We're told the name of these rivers. The first two represent the pre-imperial land of Palestine. One river flows around the place where gold was not an imperial commodity, but just good, delightful, tof in Hebrew, just like the rest of creation. And one is Gihon, the name of the sacred spring upon which the Israelites later built their temple. And of course, the Tigris and Euphrates were known to the ancients as the birthplace of civilization, but these rivers existed long before they were colonized by empire, as the blue-flowing veins of the Mesopotamian between two rivers bioregion, an ever-present reminder to all that el agua es la vida, water is life, Mina Wachone. There is such resonance between that primal story and the watershed in which we gather, and to which we endeavor to listen this weekend. There are also four primary rivers in the Mississippi watershed, as named in Algonquin. Traditional stories talk about these rivers as birthplaces, such as Bedote, we visited yesterday with Jim Bear, birthwaters of life. Geology tells us that the upper Mississippi River Valley was shaped during the most recent glacial age stage of the Great Ice Age, which started about 75,000 years ago and ended about 12,000 years ago when the North American climate began to warm. Here's what's particularly poignant about that epoch of transformation. This warm period, known as the Holocene, represents the time of ideal climate conditions that gave rise to the Neolithic Revolution and the dawn of what we know as human civilization. But what underlines the urgency of our task this weekend is the bitter fact that the Holocene epoch is coming to a premature end because of the fact that the ideology and technologies of white supremacy are transforming the climate of our blue planet. This is a graph of surface temperature of the Earth over the last 12,000 years. The spike you see at the far right is called in climate research the hockey stick line. Scientists attribute this global warming to anthropogenic causes, mostly greenhouse gas emissions. Here is that same hockey stick curve across some 24 different indices, too small to read, but includes everything from species extinction to number of cars on the road to domestication of land to global loss of biodiversity. Relentlessly the same story. Our disastrous reengineering of the planet has invoked a new definition of hubris. We are now in the age of the Anthropocene, a term coined in the 1980s by ecologist Eugene Sturmer and popularized by Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric chemist Paul Crutzen, which identifies human reengineering of the Earth as heralding the end of the hospitable Holocene and the beginning of the end game of the Anthropocene. Such graphs, as Jin mentioned, are not capable of moving our hearts and minds, nor are they abstract for us in California. This is a picture of the Ventura River by which Elaine and I reside. It hasn't flowed in 3 years. This is the worst year of a historic drought in which the snowpack of the Sierra Nevada was 5% of normal, something the chairwoman of the State Water Resources Control Board called the harbinger of things to come, the Godzilla of all wake-up calls. That's a politician talking. The drought has been intensified by the fact this year was the hottest on record, more than 3 degrees warmer than average. Peter Gleick, well known for his articulation of the peak water crisis, says this year we really started to see ecosystem damage in California. Almost 1 million acres have burned from wildfires in the state. Groundwater basins are severely depleted. Statewide reservoirs are at half their historic average, including our local one. Climate crisis isn't a prospect for us. It's a reality. There is no climate debate. There is only denial. Because of empire, history has become an ever-deepening crisis, and time is running out. The Greek term krisis connotes a crucial decision. In the New Testament, it most often means judgment in the apocalyptic sense, in which human beings reap the consequences of bad behavior, as in this poignant verse from Revelation 18 regarding the fall of Babylon, aka Rome, aka modern white supremacy, which has brought us to the Anthropocene and its interlocking social and ecological crises. This storm has been gathering, depending on how we calculate it, for the last 50 years, or maybe 500 years, or maybe 5,000 years, but it is upon our generation. This is a stunning image. in the era of superstorms. Our task as Christians, friends, is not only to respond to the environmental and social symptoms of this apocalypse. If our history is advancing toward a dead end, then it is also incumbent upon us to attend urgently to the deeper work of repentance, which is to say, to give our lives to the struggle to turn this history around. And this means working to be liberated from and to disarm the dysfunctional culture that has made our predicament inevitable, a culture in which our churches have been profoundly complicit. As I mentioned last night, in 2 years we will commemorate the quincentenary of the Protestant Reformation, launched when Martin Luther famously proclaimed, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Blessings to the many Lutherans in our midst. But it is past time for a new Reformation. The question for us is, where is the ground on which we take a stand against ecocide? For most of us in North America, our industrial culture has rendered us unable to answer the question of where we stand. We are mobile. We are more loyal to and literate in abstractions than to the biosphere in which we actually dwell. Or to paraphrase that classic annoying question from the back of the family station wagon on the road trip, are we here yet, truly inhabiting the ground on which we stand? To turn history around, we must journey up to the headwaters of the pathological culture that brought us relentlessly to this point. And this weekend, we are naming one of those primal forces as that of placelessness. At the root of the crisis of placelessness, as well as the crisis of disembodiment that Jin talked about last night, is a theological error perpetuated still in Western Christendom that has underwritten the history which has brought us to this point. It also happens to be the earliest heresy identified by the church. It's called Docetism. Docetists, under the influence of the alternative seminary's favorite philosopher, Plato, argued that if Jesus was truly God, then he couldn't really have been truly human, and vice versa. Such dualism was particularly convenient for the Constantinian project. Newly Christianized Roman emperors could claim to administer the earthly sphere and leave the heavenly one to a distant absentee landlord. The early church rightly rejected this spiritualizing, alienating ideology as heresy, but if it won the battle, it lost the war. For not only was the next millennium of imperial Christendom characterized by Docetism, but that great Reformation I just mentioned bought into it too, with a vengeance. And today, most of our churches in the West are functionally docetic. The white Jesus floats above the world in some spiritual ether sphere, placeless. Docetism's modern stranglehold on our imagination is expressed through two dogmas. One, spiritual matters must always trump terrestrial ones. And two, it is assumed that salvation occurs outside of or beyond creation. If heaven is our home, we are truly detached and numb to the escalating horrors of both social and ecological apocalypse. But this is not new. It's been the culture of whiteness for the last half millennium. The historical consequences of Docetism have already been profound and have intensified over history. Part of our task this weekend is to try to be careful and analytical in our diagnosis of our own condition. Elaine and I are working currently with a model, and we're just kind of testing it with you, that we developed of three historic phases of displacement. We might call the first and fundamental phase displacing colonization. You see, Docetism engendered a culture of displacement which began with the European alienation from their own homelands. Beginning with the so-called Age of Discovery in the 16th century, Europeans became increasingly severed from rootedness in place. In turn, they began roaming the globe, looking for lands and resources to exploit and control. This rootlessness thus drove a long history of conquest and colonization of the homelands and habitats of others, all done in the name of the heavenly docetic Christ. This right to conquest received specific ecclesial authorization, dating back to the doctrine of discovery, as you know from last year's Cannes conference, which began to be developed already a half a century before Columbus. These doctrines were enshrined in European law and continue today to justify the long and bitter history of European entitlement to other people's lands and resources. And here's the kicker. The doctrine of discovery's principle of contiguity used the geographic scope of large watersheds to expand the scope of colonialism and enabled colonizers to claim major territories as if they were unoccupied. Here's what I mean. Robert Miller writes, contiguity held that the discovery of the mouth of a river gave the discovering country claim over all of the lands drained by that river, even if it was thousands of miles of territory. Contiguity was exemplified in the seizure of the U.S. claim to the Louisiana Territory, the western drainage system of the Mississippi, and the Oregon Country, the drainage system of the Columbia River. That explains why Lewis and Clark were racing to discover the mouth of the Columbia River. This gives a certain poignancy to the work of watershed discipleship in the struggle to turn history around. And as Jin emphasized last night, not only was the land dominated, so were human bodies. Jesus' abandonment of the body gave European colonizers a rationale to enslave certain human bodies according to class, racial, and gender codes. The era of conquest was the base phase of displacement upon which all subsequent displacement is constructed. The second phase was that that we might call settlement as displaced development, which sort of reached its peak in the 19th century. By this we mean the project of immigrants who came to the New World after the initial phase of conquest was relatively complete. Now here came settlers who were by definition displaced and who imposed their will on the land rather than learning from it and who didn't recognize or learn from First Nations people because they had been mostly killed or removed. This, of course, is a long and complicated story about which Elaine will elaborate a little bit more. But this phase is best summarized in this famous painting dramatizing 19th century displacing development. You see the archetypes of mobility, the movement east to west, of economic exploitation. You see the miners and the trappers and the agriculturalists in the foreground. Political empire building, the goddess Columbia, looming above the landscape, very, very white. of technology, notice if you can see there are no less than three iron horses in the painting. This was painted just after the driving of the Golden Spike in 1869. Columbia is laying telegraph wire behind her. It's the archetype of socialization. She's holding not a Bible, wishful thinking Christians, she's holding a school book. And above all, an entitlement to the lands and resources of native people fleeing into the darkness along with the buffalo and the wild animals, our native people. This was the story of American progress from sea to shining sea. And though filled with symbols of manifest destiny, articulated with theological certitude, poor Jesus is nowhere to be found, having been safely sequestered in heaven. This second phase of displacement saw European settlers exploit now conquered places relentlessly, from early trapping and grazing to widespread logging and mining in the 19th century to today's unlimited resource extraction around the globe. the wholesale destruction of habitats in our ever more intense search for strategic resources like oil, which is extending deeper into and further across the earth, typified by tar sands extraction in northern Canada. This brings us to the final phase of alienation, as Jin talked about last night, characterized by deep socially engineered placelessness. Modern whiteness lives on top of the land, not as part of it, using places only for gain and commodification, ever mobile, which has resulted in our ecological and social crisis. Detachment from the land and from each other is now the definition of prosperity and freedom. Consider the celebrated archetypal lifestyle of the traveling global business person today, magnificently autonomous, free of constraints and limits, seeking new fortunes regardless of whether their projects might displace anyone actually rooted in their place. Most modern folk, urban folk, actually see alienation from the earth as a fundamental index of progress. Just think, friends, how many times in your life have you moved? Wendell Berry, St. Wendell Berry, laments the functionaries of globalized capitalism. He believes that for them to be able to desecrate, endanger, and destroy a place, these people must have no local allegiances. They must have no local point of view. Welcome to the world of those who plan pipelines and strip mines, resorts and suburban sprawl. And this disembodiment has a future as well as a past and present shape. Once we're done ruining this planetary home, many assume that the next logical, indeed technologically inevitable step is to inhabit either cyberspace or outer space, pillage the planet and move on. The pattern of European colonization from its inception. And friends, our docetic theologies have nothing to say. No more to offer these current violations of the bodies of earth and oppressed people than did white piety have to offer black folk under American apartheid. Indeed, spiritualized salvation doctrines are simply a different kind of exit strategy to the techno-fantasies of going to Mars. One way or the other, the promise is, beam me up, Scotty. So docetism has been a consequential heresy indeed. And many of us believe that the only antidote to the postmodern endgame of white placelessness is to embrace afresh the old wisdom of people of place. And for us, this includes scripture. This ancient story makes it clear that we must return to the earth because from it we were birthed. Scripture's unembarrassed and straightforward understanding of earth as mother was typical of old indigenous cultures, is being embraced by the new biological sciences, but has been ignored by Christians for far too long. To turn around the culture and politics of docetism, we Christians must embrace a fresh incarnation. The notion of the divine taking on flesh was as scandalous in antiquity as it is today. But from this core New Testament conviction flows the rationale for protecting and nurturing all of life. The most famous New Testament articulation of this theological counterpoint to docetism is John 1:14. And sure enough, the emphasis in the first part of this text is that the flesh, the body, the meat, nothing metaphorical about this. Modern theologians love to talk about incarnation in highly abstract terms. John's gospel, however, immediately grounds flesh in place because that is the only space that the body can inhabit. So the second part of this text deploys the verb eskinosen, which means to make an encampment. And the word pitched a tent among us, as the great Clarence Jordan's Cotton Patch translation puts it. Pictured here is a black yak hair tent that Tibetan nomads craft from their livestock. The yak hair is hand-woven by women into tough, durable material that is warm and water-resistant, bioregionally appropriate. A tent is a liminal, more humble space, not yet permanent built environment, keeping its inhabitants close to the land and its conditions. John's intenting metaphor is invoking the deep history of his people, the wilderness tradition of the Exodus, about which Miriam sang. This memory is still important in Judaism. Tents are mentioned more than 300 times in the Hebrew Bible, which is why the Feast of Booths, or tents, as a ritual of remembering, is still part of the Jewish liturgical calendar. And if you're paying attention, that feast just concluded last week, Sukkot. This notion of the incarnation, friends, implies that our Creator is hunkered down with us for the duration, sweating it out with us under climate catastrophe and social and political disaster. And make no mistake, the war in Syria is both. God is most assuredly intended among us in refugee camps and homeless squats. Incarnation can be expressed another way, as does John Levinson, Harvard Divinity School's foremost Talmudic scholar, who says, geography is simply a visible form of theology. I just want to say that again. Geography is simply a visible form of theology. In our tradition, the earth is the handiwork of Creator. I want to exegete this notion by offering two representative but radically contrasting aerial images of earth. This image is an aerial photo of the San Rafael Desert near Hanksville, Utah. It shows clearly that even in the most arid climate on the continent, the Colorado Plateau, the single most distinctive and defining feature is the way the water flows. This, of course, is a universal geographic characteristic true everywhere on the planet. A theological reading of this picture would conclude that fluvial geomorphology, or patterning of how water flows, represents the chief design feature of creation. This second image represents a stark contrast of how our civilization has settled on the earth. It's an aerial view of nearby Las Vegas, which exhibits patterns of built environment typical of modern urban sprawl throughout North America. What's most evident here is not how the water flows, in fact, that is invisible, but rather how the automobile traffic and housing tracks flow. This equally arid landscape has been almost completely redesigned according to human artifice and exclusively to meet human need, or more accurately, to the interests of the capitalist elites. Our habitation footprint erases place beneath us, perhaps the ultimate expression of displaced and displacing placelessness. The profound difference between the design patterns of nature and the modern metropolis express one essential aspect of what is unsustainable about industrial civilization. If the design orthodoxies of our built environment have brought us to the brink of ecological and social collapse, then a radical response is called for, one that goes to the roots of how this problem was formed. We have lost our way as creatures of God's biosphere, and only the map that is woven into creation can lead us home. And that map is defined by how water flows. John Wesley Powell, one-armed Civil War veteran, surveyor of the American West, and the first non-native person to raft successfully down the Colorado River in the 1860s, inaugurated the modern recovery of this ancient map in his enduring definition of a watershed. It is that area of land, a bounded hydrologic system within which all living things are inextricably linked by their common water course, and where, as humans settled, simple logic demanded that they become part of that community. But whiteness was not interested in becoming part of that community. And now we are in an end game. The more than 2,000 primary watersheds in the continental U.S. come in all sizes. Yours is the largest. The Mississippi River Basin drains 41% of the lower 48 states into the Gulf of Mexico. Where Elaine and I live is one of the smallest. The Ventura River watershed covers a scant 227 square miles. Mapping is a kind of pattern literacy, and how we map places shapes our imagination. In Western culture, our social and ecological worldviews have been profoundly shaped by two-dimensional maps, political maps, from schoolhouse walls to fold-out guides for driving trips to the GPS on your smart-ass phone. For example, here's a map of the boundaries of Ventura County, where Elaine and I live, overlaid onto the five watersheds in our area. The disconnect of the two paradigms, I hope, is apparent. Political boundaries are usually straight. No continental U.S. state is without one, while watershed ones never are. Straight lines are the first order of abstraction, as any native person will tell you. Jim Baer talked about it yesterday. They alienate us from the topographical and hydrological realities that, in fact, sustain us. Political maps are also, of course, social reproductions that enshrine problematic historical legacies of colonization and exploitation, while rendering nature secondary or altogether invisible. Do you recognize that map? Of course you do. It's been burned into your consciousness since you were old enough to make sense of images. Here is a reimagined watershed map of the U.S. using hydrologic unit code data by John Levy in 2013, but inspired by John Wesley Powell's work in the 19th century. Just sit with the differences for a minute. How might our political culture change if the basic unit of governance was, as Kirkpatrick Sale puts it, nature rather than legislature? Watershed remapping is a practical tool for battling placeless abstractions while advancing our literacy in the real, because it is the real that is threatening to collapse, and our built artifices cannot save us. Living as we do on top of places, our ignorance is a costly form of docetism. We have no idea where to find basic things like water or food or shelter, as pretty much all human beings did up until a century or two ago. Peter Warshall has done a great exercise many of you have worked with called The Big Here, in which we quiz ourselves to figure out whether we can actually trace water we drink from rainfall to tap, whether we know that when we flush, where do the solids go? And by the way, why are we shitting in our fresh water? It's madness. What spring wildflowers are consistently among the first to bloom in your watershed? How far do you have to travel before you reach a different watershed? Is the soil under your feet clay, sand, rock, or silt? Name five edible plants in your neighborhood and the seasons they are available. The modern response? Whatever. A quarter century ago, Gary Snyder, celebrated poet of the modern ecology movement, contended that it's not enough just to love nature or to want to be in harmony with Gaia. Our relationship to the natural world takes place in a place, and it must be grounded in the information and experience of that place. In a seminal essay entitled Coming Into the Watershed, Snyder wrote, "The usual focus of attention for most Americans is the human society with its problems and successes, icons and symbols. The land we all live on is simply taken for granted, and proper relation to it is not taken as part of citizenship. But people are beginning to wake up and notice that the United States is located on a landscape with a severe, spectacular, spacey, wildly demanding, and ecstatic narrative to be learned." Go with Jim Baer Jacobs and learn the narrative of this watershed. Its natural communities are each unique, and each of us, whether we like it or not, in the city or countryside, live in one of them. When enough people get that picture, our political life will begin to change, and it will be the next phase of American life, coming to live on Turtle Island. Snyder then uses the venerable biblical language of being born again to describe the conversion required to transform our relationship with our watersheds. Elaine wasn't kidding last night when she asked you if you're ready to be born again this weekend. Which brings us theologically back to where I began this morning and where we began at sunrise. The birth waters of baptism. John the Baptist opened our time together this morning. The gospel narrative of Jesus' baptism can teach us several things about faith and the crisis of placelessness. First, it takes place in a political, social, and geographic context. We're told in the Synoptic Gospels that Jesus went to apprentice with John the Baptizer at the furthest margins of society, deep in the Jordan Rift Valley, far from the urban-based soldiers and traders and managers of first-century Roman-occupied Palestine. The wilderness location of this renewal movement means to remind us of the origins of Israel's faith. The God of Exodus stands outside of civilization, undomesticated and wild. So John invites his people into the sacred waters of the Jordan, far from the domesticated ritual baths of city or village. The Gospels further make it clear that John's project is rehabilitating the vocation of Israelite prophecy. Isaiah foretold the recovery of a way in the wilderness, a double reference to the way of the Exodus in the past and the coming way of discipleship of Jesus. And central to the Baptist message is the challenge to turn history around. The history that was killing his people, the history that is killing us. This call to repentance was particularly directed at the local authorities. John exposes their presumption. I think I went one too far. There we go. John exposes their presumption of entitlement, an issue profoundly germane to our discussion of settler identity today. And note John's image of the axe being laid to the root. This is a radical analysis, striking at the root of the problem, not a mere hope for cosmetic reform. So it is significant that Jesus begins his ministry by immersing himself in the prophetic tradition and then immersing his body in the wild Jordan River. But here's what's really cool. In Mark's baptism narrative, all the others coming out to John are baptized in the Jordan, Greek preposition en. Jesus, however, is baptized into the river, Greek eston Jordan. To underlie this prepositional distinction, a wild bird then descends eis auton, onto, into Jesus. And after this epiphany, Jesus is driven by the Spirit deeper into the wilderness, eis ten eremon, on a kind of vision quest to discover the roots of the historic crisis of his people. Theologians usually understand Jesus' baptism as a power empowerment from above. But I think we could argue that Jesus actually was being inspirited from below through a deep immersion into his beloved homeland, grounding him in the storied land of his ancestors. Right there at Bedote, Jim, through which the Creator still speaks. And as Jesus comes up out of the waters, having immersed himself in the place and the primal stories of his people, another wild moment erupts. The skies are opened, and Isaiah's prophetic longing to make God's name known to Israel's enemies is realized. Hey, I'm right here in a yak hair tent. Deal with me. The heavens are rent asunder. The silenced voice of God speaks again. Being born again into the watershed, the sacred wild spaces of land groaning under Roman imperialism prepared Jesus for his campaign to liberate and heal his people and places, and nothing less will prepare us for ours. This baptism scene ends, as you know, with a simple statement, and then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, an even deeper immersion into place and story. There Jesus faces down the devil's three archetypal temptations: economic exploitation, turning stones into bread; political domination, Satan's offer to gift all the kingdoms of the world; and the consciousness of entitlement, Satan's offer to rescue Jesus from a fall from the temple pinnacle. We spent an entire institute a couple of years ago studying just these three temptations. In other words, Jesus faces down the history of whiteness and chooses life because he is rooted in the stories that save us from illness and death. This is the vision quest that is leading many of us to embrace the contention first made in 1968 by the Senegalese environmentalist Baba Diom, that we won't save places that we don't love, and we can't love places that we don't know, and we can't know places that we haven't learned. From the beginning of the human journey on this planet, nothing was more crucial to the survival and flourishing of traditional societies than literacy in and symbiotic relationship with the bioregional context. This remains the case today, but my Lord, do we have a long way to go to relearn it. Our phrase, as most of you know, of watershed discipleship means to represent an intentional triple entendre. It recognizes that we are in a watershed moment of historical crisis, which demands that environmental and social justice and sustainability be integral to everything we do as Christians and as citizen inhabitants of specific places. It also acknowledges the inescapably bioregional locus of an incarnational following of Jesus. Our discipleship and the life of the local church inescapably takes place in a watershed context. And finally, it implies that we have to become disciples of our watersheds, to learn them, to know our place enough to love it, enough to save it. This is the contextual and be saved by it. This is the contextual, practical, constructive approach required by the crisis of the Anthropocene, by the invitation of incarnation, and by the realities of place. So that's one of the reasons we convened this collaborative institute to work on understanding Christian discipleship fundamentally as a commitment to heal the world and be healed by the watershed by restoring social and ecological health. We believe ecclesial communities of place can make an enormous contribution to the wider historic struggle to reverse our social and ecological catastrophes and in the process recover the soul of our faith tradition. We're convinced that watershed discipleship not only holds the key to our survival as a species, it can also inspire the next reformation in light of, not despite of, the looming endgame we face. If you want to learn more about watershed discipleship, I invite you to join the workshop later this morning. This approach, importantly, rehabilitates the single most central aspect of our scriptural tradition, that of covenant. A trust-based, promise-dependent relationship with Creator, with community, and with the land on which we dwell. So we believe that baptism, our central Christian liturgical sign of discipleship, needs to be replaced in the life of our churches. Baptism invites us not only to immerse ourselves into the way of Jesus, but also, like Jesus' own baptism, to re-inhabit our home watersheds, to learn, to know, to love, to save and be saved. And as our baptismal vows put it, to repent and resist the works of the devil, now fully revealed in the Anthropocene, and to rise to new life. I began this segment talking about the headwaters of our scriptural canon in Genesis. Well, way downstream, at the very end of our New Testament canon, we find John the Revelator's remarkable vision of God's transfiguration of the world back to communion. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the skene of God is among mortals. God will skinose with them. They will be God's peoples, and God will dwell with them." Here is a double iteration of the fourth gospel's notion of God tented among us. But that's not all. Because John's river of the water of life, Mine Wachone, reveals a rich theological and ecological texture which effectively brackets the biblical canon with the imaginary of primal birth waters John's eschatological river contrasts starkly with the arid realities of his desert readers, who would have been familiar only with the stagnant, torpid water found in seasonal wells or catchment tanks or clay pots. John's river shines like crystal. That's no more and no less than a description of healthy, flowing water. This signals a dramatic restoration of life to the land and those dwelling on it, just as the Hebrew prophets had imagined. But here's the really interesting thing theologically. John goes on to tell us that those waters of life are not just springing up from the headwaters, from the ground. They are proceeding from the throne of God. This primal notion of Yahweh as a cosmic spring echoes the psalmist, "For with you is the fountain of life." Moreover, the river flows through the middle of the great street of the city, John tells us. The Greek term plateia connoted the main thoroughfare or plaza of a Hellenistic metropolis. Poignantly, earlier in the apocalypse, this plateia was the space of political violence, where the bodies of two prophets murdered by empire lay in public view for 3.5 days as a spectacle of state terror. Hands up, don't shoot! But now New Jerusalem's main street has dissolved into a river of life. And this river washes away not only the raw sewage that typically would have run down the gutters of an ancient plateia, but it washes away the blood spilled by empire. And finally, as in Ezekiel 47, John's freely and abundantly flowing river provides habitat for the tree of life with good medicine, specifically for the nations. That would be us. Even empire is healed in the end, but only when its built environment is eclipsed by the ecology of life. It is into this river of the water of life that we are invited by the Bedote and the Baptist to begin our apprenticeship to the watershed and to take our stand somewhere against the catastrophe of empire.
See what the Lord has provided. Yes, yes. And tell me, do you love God? Then take care of the fish. You give a man a fish, and he will eat for a day. Teach him how to fish, and he will eat until the owner of the pond comes and arrests him for trespassing. Organize that person with his neighbors to push for the renewal of the commons against the privatization of water, and we have a new beginning. And I see, I hear, I feel many hoping, praying, longing for a new beginning, for the depths of what we have made is sinking. It is finally sinking, and we must let it sink. Let it sink in. Those chaos waters are throbbing again. They are pulling, pulling with the moon, the old, old tidal tribal rhythms singing back to the dark, back to the deep. And the waters have asked me, who will walk through this threshold? How many among those praying for newness know what they must pass through? How many would if they knew what must come? Who will come and swim? Who will let themselves be submerged? Who will drown for the sake of reemerging as a new creation? How many of those praying for newness will stop being so watered down and truly go down into the water? Who will enter the dark and deep? Who will sing with me?
Yes.
And drop right down to the water hole.
Drop right down to the water hole.
And let it liquefy my soul.
Let it liquefy my soul.
Fill it up till my cup does overflow.
Fill it up till my cup does overflow.
And justice like that river rolls.
And justice like that river rolls.
Oh, now drop right down into the water hole.
Drop right down to the water hole.
Let it liquefy my soul.
Let it liquefy my soul.
Fill it up till my cup does overflow.
Fill it up till my cup does overflow.
And justice like that river rolls.
And justice like that river
rolls. All together now, drop right down to the water hole. Let it liquefy my soul. Fill it up till my cup does overflow. And justice like that river rolls. Drop right down to the water hole. Let it liquefy my soul. Fill it up till my cup does overflow. Justice like that river roll. Justice like that river roll. Justice like that river roll. Yes, justice like the river roll. We must go down into the water hole, that deep, dark, dirty water hole. And we must all be baptized in the dirty water, because all the water is dirty. We have fouled the wells. They are poisoned, toxic sludge. We have damned the water. We have damaged the water. The triclosan soap infused in our blood. The arsenic and radiation contaminate the mud. Shoot the diesel down the frack hole and poison the well. Light your water on fire and welcome to hell. This is not the good way. This is what the Lord says to stand at the crossroads and look.
To ask for the ancient paths. To ask where the good way
you will find rest for your soul. But you said we will not walk in it. Instead, you want to reform creation to suit your wills and desires. Is it you, reformers? You who reverse the channel's flow, who dam the rivers, who poison the rain and bury the creeks. I tell you, you who believe your technologies will save you, you believe in a false reality. And I pray that we will return to the rain, to follow the polluted water, back down through the poisoned soil until we sink deep enough back to our roots. This baptismal call is a warning that your sanitation will not bring you transformation. Your underground sewer systems no longer hide the rising stench of spiritual decay. This is not a call for technologies and programs. This is not shopping advice on how to consume more responsibly. This is a call to put our faces in the mess we have made and feel the grief of the water. This is the voice of one crying in the wilderness, still trying to make a way for the Lord. And we must all baptize ourselves in this dirty water. For there is one coming who will baptize us all with fire. So let us return to the source. Let us wade through this deep water and try and find our way home. For I know I've been changed. Yes, I know that I've been changed. I know that I have been changed. Oh, angels in heaven done signed my name. The angels in heaven done signed my name. Well, I know I've got religion, and Lord knows I am not ashamed. Well, if the Holy Ghost is my witness, and the angels done sign my name, yes, I know I've been changed. I know that I've been changed. I know that I have been changed. Oh, angels in heaven done signed my name. Angels in heaven done signed my name. And I know I've been converted. And Lord knows I've been redeemed. Well, you can wake me up in the midnight hour, and I'm gonna show you just what I see. Oh, I know I've been changed. Yeah, I know that I've been changed. I know that I have been changed. Angels in heaven done signed my name. Angels in heaven done signed my name. Angels in heaven done signed my name.
My roots are also in a radical rebaptizing movement. I believe Jay was about to Get me right there. That mic is fine. Thank you. Thank you, John the Baptist. Thank you, Miriam. Are you going to lower this for me? Thank you for lowering that. Community in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And in recent studies, I looked at barriers within my settler Mennonite community in building relationships of solidarity with our Indigenous neighbors. Part of my research focused on silences in our communal narrative around land and displacement of Native people. And that's what I want to reflect on with you this morning. This is also my first time. Yes. Here again is the image of the three broad historic layers of displacement that we are dealing with this weekend. Ched focused on our alienation from place and the task of recovering right relations to our bioregions. I will look at the parallel and interconnected responsibility of discovering right relations to the traditional peoples of our respective places. I want to do a brief exercise to get a sense of who is in the room and the migration stories represented here. And if you are willing to play along with me, this will also give you a brief moment to stretch. So please stand, if you are able, when I call out a group that describes you. First, can those of you who are Indigenous to Turtle Island please stand? Thank you. We honor you. And please take a stretch, because we've been sitting a while. However it feels good, thank you. Now, for all of the rest of us who have immigrated here, whether it was forced or voluntary, think back to at least one of the immigrant generations of your family genealogy. So please stand if you had an ancestor who came to North America before 1800. Thank you, and again, do a little stretch. Please stand if you had an ancestor who came to North America in the 19th century. Yes. And your shoulder rolls. Thank you. And then, those of us who came in the 20th century. There are a few of us. Thank you. Anyone in the last 15 years that has come, thank you. Whether we immigrated to a place or were born into a place, either way, we stepped into a story and a landscape that has been defined by issues of violence and violation, power struggles, and occasionally, generosity and equity. The landscape has already been imprinted with these things, and we are inheritors of the history that took place in each of the specific watersheds we inhabit. As Jim Baer reminded us yesterday, stories are not about time, but about place. All of our watersheds carry stories. In restorative justice work with situations of crime, we acknowledge with both victims and offenders what would really make things right would be to go back in time and undo the violation, have it not happen. But of course, that is not possible. So the question becomes, what can be done to address and repair this situation now? This also applies to the larger narrative of history. History is about what did happen, not what should have happened. However, if we choose to ignore that history, then we are living on top of our places rather than into them, and thus are part of its continuing exploitation. In contrast, our discipleship responsibility to re-inhabit a watershed is to encounter the peopled stories of a place and privileging the stories of those who have been marginalized or traumatized or disappeared. But part of what makes it difficult for us to do that work is the fact that we are socialized, either as US-born or as immigrants, into communal narratives that often distort, devise, or dismember the histories of our place. These communal narratives include family lore, official community accounts of the settler legacy, and national myths. They are imprinted onto our psyche and soul through family traditions, race and class socialization, the education system, and the dominant media. To take the most public example, the trite and thoroughly discredited old trope that Columbus discovered America, that is the battleground of the holiday we commemorate this weekend. This devising of history continues to wield widespread cultural power and persuasion. The challenge for us, in Audre Lorde's words, is to do our own work, which means coming to critical consciousness about what we have inherited, working somatically with what we carry in our bones, and revising devised narratives and remembering dismembered stories. In our 2009 book, Ambassadors of Reconciliation, Volume 2, Diverse Christian Practices of Restorative Justice and Peacemaking, I explored how principles and practices of restorative justice might be applied to historic and continuing injustices, and offered a working definition of what historical responsibility might look like. In the case of the colonial legacy in North America, this requires us settlers to do our own work to build empathy with Native communities victimized by historic and current injustices. Listening to how they are identifying harms, needs, and responsibilities, and investigating our complicity, and working with them to make things as right as possible, which can include covenants of accountability, restitution, reparations, and ideally, reconciliation. What I call restorative solidarity recognizes past and continuing injustices and seeks to make things right, both in ourselves and with those who have been violated. If we ever want to come fully into our watershed, then historical responsibility for settlers will include three interrelated tasks: to encounter the truth about our immigrant history, where we came from, and why and how we came; to encounter the truth about the history of the land and the peoples we came to; to hold our communal narratives, dominant culture socialization, and public myths accountable to these truths we have encountered. I use the term encounter here rather than listen, because this is not about head knowledge. It requires a complete engagement of mind and heart, body and soul. My job this morning is to encourage both old and new immigrants to the kind of work required for restorative solidarity with Indigenous communities in the places we have settled. Let me say a brief word about each of these three ways of engagement, because I do believe this represents a sort of map of how to embrace historical responsibility. And in each case, I will illustrate the broad patterns with how it has impacted my own family story. So first, we need to encounter the truth of our immigrant history, where we came from, and why and how we came. We settlers have fractured identities, which are predicated upon denial and or ignorance. We often don't know our familial immigrant history, nor how those experiences reflect the broader historical patterns of this nation. Like Jin said last night, most immigration over the last 500 years has been driven by white supremacy. We typically ignore the deepest two layers of the colonial project: the destruction of indigenous cultures and peoples, and the violent removal of millions of Africans to the Americas in the slave trade. This denial is compounded by our tendency to shed our European ethnicity and assimilate into white privilege. When I ask Euro-Americans if they know what their ancestry is, they often quip, "I'm a European mutt." This comment is often accompanied by laughter. And I really wonder, is this to shrug off the discomfort or to mask the pain? That pain tends to be clearer to those whose ancestors were slaves, who often have no record or only a very general sense of where their people came from. So shrugging off painful history, it's part of our white privilege or supremacy. The construction of the U.S. as a dominant nation was a lengthy historical project that centered around European immigration. This chart is of the top recorded ancestries in the U.S. as provided by the 2000 census. And you'll note that the largest geographic spread was settled by Germans. Now, what do you know, all of those of us who have immigrated here, about your immigrant origins? Our mentor, Dr. Vincent Harding of blessed memory, used to begin his facilitation of groups by asking this question: what language did your big mama's big mama speak? How were distinctive cultural traditions lost in your family through assimilation? Whiteness is a social construction of the dominant cultural project in this country. Shedding European ethnicity and assuming white privileges involves distancing ourselves from our ancestors. Thus, even if we do know something of our heritage, many of us are just not interested in discussing it. Ancestry just isn't that important. But this ambivalence not only renders us orphans, it also functions to suppress or dismiss the history of colonization and settlement and assimilation, with which we must have a fresh encounter because issues of justice and identity remain unresolved. This graph shows how in 1910, the percentage of foreign-born was almost at 15%, and then has declined throughout the century. But in 2005, where this graph ends, the numbers are climbing back up to above 12%. So the U.S. continues to be
a nation of immigrants. Yet because of assimilation into white privilege, we are also a nation with a long history of anti-immigrant prejudice. So it is important for settler recovery to encounter the realities of how and why people emigrate. There are many, of course, whose emigration was completely involuntary. But for most others, immigration has also been a part of a struggle to survive. Many emigres were pushed from their homelands and/or livelihoods by military, political, and economic forces beyond their control. But if in our assimilation we tend to ignore our personal family histories, how much more do we overlook these structural forces that impel immigration from generation to generation? But this ignorance is a part of white privilege, loss of identity, and the continuation of patterns of injustice. Throughout history, the political winds of conquest and settlement and the global economic currents of boom and bust push and pull people like great tides. And I will name just the three most important ones. First, war has been and continues to be one major factor. For example, we can trace immigration patterns over the last half century directly to the impact of U.S. policies towards sending countries. U.S. military intervention in the Dominican Republic brought some 60,000 Dominicans to the U.S. in the 1960s. The war in Indochina brought tens of thousands of Southeast Asians as refugees in the 1970s. A decade of U.S.-sponsored counterinsurgency warfare in the 1980s in Central America brought hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans, Nicaraguans, and Guatemalans. And over the last quarter century, U.S. interventions in the Arab world have increased those populations here as well. How did war and conflict shape your family history of immigration? I know these forces in my own bones. I'm a descendant of the Ruslander, Mennonites who came from Russia to Canada in the 1920s after the Russian Civil War. From 1917 to 1921, my people survived what one historian calls, quote, a continuous climate of violence, plundering, rape, mass killings, and extensive bloodbaths with gruesome mutilations, end quote. One of the worst incidents was a massacre in Eichenfeld, in which one October night in 1919, rebel forces wiped out most of the men, murdering 136 people and raping many women. In the 1920s, over 20,000 Mennonites fled Russia and flooded into Saskatchewan. Much of my research has to do with understanding the context of that violence, how and why my people were caught in it, and how we were also part of social inequalities that generated that violence. I'm also interested in how these events spawned intergenerational trauma. Within my Ruslander community, there is a disproportionate rate of depression, anxiety, and other mental illness. But the connections between these diseases and past trauma is rarely acknowledged. How do you carry in your bones the wounds resulting from how your people might have been both victims of war, but also complicit in injustice? Economic policies are the second major force that drives immigration. For example, industrialization and its relentless resource and labor extraction has moved people around the globe for centuries. There were three great migrations to and within the U.S. due to industrialization between the end of the Civil War in 1865 and through World War II. African Americans fleeing the Jim Crow South migrated north to work in factories in cities like Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh. Poor Europeans were heavily recruited to the U.S. around the turn of the century, also for these factory jobs. And Mexican and Haitian farm labor was imported in multiple waves to work in the fields of industrial agriculture. At the same time, the boom and bust cycles of mining or logging or railroad towns kept other domestic populations moving around the landscape, and economics has kept people migrating from rural areas to the cities. What political forces of boom or bust, or poverty or affluence, shape the movement of your people? These economic forces also determine political currents, the third great force, particularly around fluctuations in U.S. immigration policy throughout history. For example, during the railroad boom of the 1860s and 70s, the Chinese contract laborers were actively recruited. But then, in 1882, as the railroad bubble was bursting, the Chinese exclusion law was passed. Similarly, Mexican workers were actively sought due to a worldwide labor shortage. A half million were then deported during the Depression of the 1930s. Mexican agricultural workers were again recruited during World War II through the Bracero program, only to be deported in the Eisenhower administration's Operation Wetback. In the case of my family, the Canadian government heavily recruited European immigrants in the early 20th century, billing the prairies as the Golden West, a home for all people. At the same time, Mennonites in Canada, aware of the calamitous impact of civil war and revolution in Russia, formed Mennonite Central Committee, which lobbied the Canadian government to allow their co-religionists to immigrate to Canada. Thus, between 1923 and 1929, again, over 20,000 Russian Mennonites immigrated to Canada, including all four of my grandparents. So the political forces of social upheaval in one part of the world and colonial strategies of settlement of frontier lands in the other part of the world were what shaped my family history. How did political opportunity or oppression move you or your ancestors around the globe? In order to attend to issues of justice in our adopted homes as settlers, we need to have a keen sense of how these issues shaped our immigration histories and indeed what we carry in our bones, whether we are fully aware of it or not. So a fresh and critical encounter with our own displacements is a key part of the work of restorative solidarity. The second task of historical responsibility is for settlers to encounter the truth of the land and the peoples we came to. So, what do you know about your immigrant ancestors' first contacts with Indigenous peoples? What do you know about how they acquired land or why they couldn't? Unlike most Euro-Americans, Mennonites tend to be very interested in our history. My family has no less than 7 family history books that detail our migration journey from Prussia in the late 1780s. And I saw a great chuckle from a fellow Mennonite out there. My family is not alone. These books highlight how Catherine the Great invited Mennonites to settle the steppes of Russia and Ukraine in the late 1700s. Yet no mention is made in these books of the Nogai or Cossack peoples, the traditional inhabitants of these lands, being forcibly removed by the Tsarina just prior to my ancestors arriving. Similarly, a century later, and half a world away, Mennonite settlers from Manitoba and the U.S. procured land in Saskatchewan that had just been taken from Cree tribes by the Canadian government. But not a whisper of the latter in my family books. In most cases, Indigenous people are simply not a part of our settler Mennonite narrative. Is this true in your family stories as well? Such silences fail to recognize that the underside of immigrant opportunity was Native displacement. When the Native narrative is disappeared, it is replaced by a dangerous fantasy embraced by many settlers that the land upon which we settled was essentially uninhabited and it was free for the taking. This destructive myth dates back to the terra nullius aspect of the medieval doctrine of discovery that Chad mentioned, and it still undergirds rationalizations of the European conquest and colonization of the Americas, as you studied in some depth at this conference a year ago. In working with settler Mennonites, I often facilitate a timeline exercise in which we construct a parallel chronology of our migration stories on one line and Indigenous history on the other. Participants typically know in great detail their family and community's history, but are able to plot only a few events on the Indigenous line. One research participant put it, "Aboriginal history was invisible in the family stories I learned." It has been clear, it has become clear from my work that the majority of us Mennonites not only do not know the Indigenous story of the land we call home, but seem to not care about it. Aidan Enns of G's Magazine has brought copies of their new issue on decolonization, and it includes an article where I describe this difficult and unsettling work of remembering the dismembered histories of the land we inhabit. The same thing that is true of the watershed we inhabit is true of the people's stories of that place. We won't work for restorative justice in our place if we don't care about its first peoples. And we won't care about them if their narrative is invisible. And we cannot know their stories unless we are very intentional about learning from and listening to first peoples. That is central to the work of this conference and the journey of restorative solidarity. We must create spaces to do this work and take advantage of every opportunity offered by the traditional caretakers of this land to learn and grow into right relations. A third major responsibility for us settlers is to encounter the communal narratives, dominant culture socialization, and public myths. Nothing in our dominant media, and very little, if anything, in our educational system encourages our literacy in these matters. Settlers and new immigrants alike are socialized and educated into myths, lies, and half-truths. Judge Murray Sinclair, chair of the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, named this problem in his opening comments at each of the regional hearings. The Indian residential school legacy is not an Indian problem, he said. It is a Canadian problem, and all Canadians must take responsibility. Because at the same time that Native children were taught inferiority, non-Native children in public schools were implicitly and sometimes explicitly taught superiority. This work, this healing, takes courage. Because of these efforts, public schools in Canada are required to teach treaty history and commitments. Sadly, I believe that we are far from this in the United States. Dominant settler narratives are reinforced by the stories told in our families, communities, or ethnic and religious groups. European pioneer narratives typically emphasize heroic tales of hardworking, faithful, and resilient people, while omitting contradictory or shameful details of how we got that land or what happened to Indigenous communities. Such narratives of innocence or nobility legitimate settler privilege and encode attitudes of superiority. In my Mennonite settler community, for example, a common narrative is that we came to this land and we made it better, more productive, insinuating that before Europeans arrived, the prairies were neither tended nor cared for properly. This attitude of superiority prevents us from learning from traditional Indigenous life ways, which surely were more sustainable than those we Westerners have imported here. Similarly, the individualist myth of "we did it ourselves" fails to recognize the many instances in which settlers survived initially only because of the aid, compassion, and knowledge of their Indigenous neighbors. Here is an example from my community. Amelia Wheeler and her husband Isbrand had come from Prussia to Rostron, Saskatchewan in 1894. But Isbrand died shortly after their arrival, leaving Amelia in a new country to raise a family of 9 children. And soon there was nothing to eat. And in desperation, Amelia sent 2 of her sons to a nearby Cree chief for help. The ice across the South Saskatchewan River was already breaking up, and it would soon be impossible to cross to the store. Hearing of their desperate plight, the chief risked his life by jumping across the perilous river on the ice floes to get to the store, then recrossing it with much-needed supplies for the widow and her children. Some Mennonites with whom I talk protest that we survived horrible violence and pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. Why can't Native people do the same? This attitude is a double devising of history. On one hand, it ignores the long history of systemic dispossession of Indigenous communities through broken treaties, land confiscation, forced assimilation, and racist law enforcement. And on the other hand, it refuses to take into account the preferential treatment that many Mennonite settlers enjoyed because they were European. Ignorance about Native realities, historically and in the present, is a learned condition, and it creates the vacuum in which devised histories and myths flourish. So part of our work is to critically revise both intimate family legends and lore that encode settler privilege and the more public narratives that dominate the landscape. This includes all the ways in which white settlers and place names and political events are memorialized in plaques and parks and Capitol buildings, while Native memory is not. Although we learned yesterday that the art in the Minnesota Capitol building may be changing. Restoring right relations will involve listening to Indigenous perspectives and revising many of our cherished settler communal narratives. Yesterday, Jim Baer, during the Sacred Sites tour, took us to Bedote, the Dakota sacred land where the Grandmother's Walk commemorates the Dakota who died in 1862. The marchers walk 150 miles, calling out loud and writing on stakes the names of the victims of the Mankato execution, the concentration camp, and the forced march. How painful it is that the slogan of Black Lives Matter movement today, commemorating those who are killed by police, insist that we must say her name. As I mentioned earlier, Canada just completed a national TRC commission that spanned a 7-year period. Part of our temptation as Christian settlers is to leapfrog over this difficult work to get to reconciliation with our Indigenous brothers and sisters. But if we do not do this work around the issues described above, that amounts to what Bonhoeffer famously called, cheap grace. This is demanding work, but not as impossible as our settler shame might imagine. Let me close by telling you about an experiment in historical responsibility and restorative solidarity among my people in Saskatchewan. In the late 1970s, Mennonite Central Committee learned that Mennonites had settled on land that was taken from the Young Chippewyan tribe by the government without consultation or compensation in the 1890s. And this tribe has since been landless and federally unrecognized, and there are many tribes in Canada and the United States who have this status. It has been a long struggle to learn and educate about this history, and many Mennonites living in this area remain fearful or uninterested, but some have joined the effort to address this historic injustice. Ray Funk, who was born and raised close to this land, explains what is developing. We got a mandate from MCC to create a mechanism that would become a land trust to which Mennonites could contribute money to help landless bands establish a base for themselves. We will give priority to places where Mennonite settlers have displaced First Nations in Canada. We will call it something like a Treaty Appreciation Fund, an entity to which settlers can contribute and make good on treaty. We are suggesting perhaps only 1% of one's gross income or 10% of capital gains on property. As you can imagine, this has been a controversial idea, one that challenges Mennonites to deconstruct some of our privileges, even to the point of redistributing some of our land entitlements. Just like the story of the rich man called to discipleship by Jesus in this Sunday's gospel reading. Whether we are up to the challenge of such reparation will depend upon our ability to see the ongoing disparities between us and our Indigenous neighbors that represent a form of violence that must be reduced and eradicated as part of truly restorative solidarity. What symbolic gestures and substantive projects of restorative solidarity are being incubated in your watershed? How can you lend your support? It is necessary but not sufficient to acknowledge Indigenous peoples, to thank them for their hospitality. To fully immerse ourselves in our watershed, to go down into the storied waters of our place like Jesus did, to arise to a vision of beloved community, and to journey into the wilderness of testing is the vocation of a replaced church. May we follow Jesus into this watershed to learn enough to know enough to care, and to care enough to embrace the work of restorative solidarity. I end with a beautiful benediction by Irish poet Seamus Heaney. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. they get hurt and get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Miriam.
What do we have? What do we have? What did I have but a voice to tell a story, to proclaim liberty? No magic tricks and no miracles and no history. No magic stick or stone of law. You who believe God spoke only through Moses, bury me in the desert. You will have drought and miserable dryness. Your aquifers will be sucked dry, your fertile land plowed away, your water owned by the high and mighty, bought and sold. You will have drought and spiritual dryness. But you who remember me, who remember my music, you will feel me beneath your feet like cool ground water through porous stone. Follow, Miriam. Follow the story. Follow the drum. Follow me. I, who am Miriam.
Who can't save a place that you don't love? River flows down to the valley from the mountain above. You can't love a place that you don't know. Realize what should die so the good can grow. You can't know a place that you haven't learned. Oh, bust down the dam and let the river return. Then we can wade in the water. Wade in the water, children. Wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. Who are those children all dressed in blue? God's gonna trouble the water. Yeah, there must be those who have passed on through. And God's gonna trouble the water. Wade in the water. Wade in the water, children. In the water, God's gonna trouble the water. Who are those children all dressed in white? God's gonna trouble the water. I must be those who've seen the light. God's gonna trouble the water. Wade in the water. Wade.
shadows, children all dressed in green. God's gonna trouble the water. Well, there must be those who've been washed clean. God's gonna trouble the water. Wait in the water. Wait in the water. Children, wait in the water. God's gonna trouble. God's gonna trouble.